Voices of the Temple, official podcast of the Temple of Witchcraft, exploring mystery and magic through love, will, and wisdom, hosted by Adam Sartwell.
Hi, listeners. Before I get into who I am with today, let us get into sacred space with each other. So take a deep breath. As we call to the Great Spirit, we call to the two who move as one, through the three rays of love, will, and wisdom. I call upon the goddess, maiden, mother, and crone, past, present, and future, creator, sustainer, destroyer, weaver of the web. I call to the god, lord of light and lord of darkness, God of the green and the gold, God of the horn and the red, singer of the song. Be with us now and forever, so mote it be. All right. So I am here with the wonderful Nicholas Pearson, and we're here to talk all about his amazing books and work and all of that. So if you would like to say hello, Nicholas.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
That's awesome. All right. Well, I feel good that you've listened to them. So, how do you spiritually identify?
I think I'm probably not alone in saying that I wear a lot of hats. And if I were going to like pick one to kind of lead with, it's the role of the witch, because that essentially encompasses a lot of the other things that I do. It allows me to be a learner, a mystic, a healer. So many other things are kind of tied up into that. And I always try to meet other people where they're at. So I don't want to say that I filter necessarily the role that I'm wearing, but different kind of archetypal roles will come through in my work. But definitely, I consider myself a witch, an occultist, a healer, an amateur academic, very amateur, but I can't keep but continue learning. And I think those are things that really inform my spirituality overall.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can, as you were saying that, I was sort of imagining, you have your witch hat and then you're just sort of putting on the scarf on top of it, you know, that this is today I'm a spiritual healer, or, you know, like some sort of decoration. So diving right into it. So what is your spiritual origin story?
You know, it all goes back to just being kind of a weird kid. Like I didn't have massive friend group growing up, and initially I came from a single parent household, and when other families did church on weekends, my dad and I would go to the public library, and it was just this teeny tiny little branch in this little coastal community in Southeast Florida where I'm from. And you know, some years later they built a fancy new branch. They must have gotten, you know, a massive endowment to do this. You know, one week it might be a stack of books about the ocean and rocks and, you know, other things related to science. And then the next week it was, you know, ancient Egyptian mythology or European fairy tales. And I grew to kind of love these parallel worlds of the natural sciences and the folklore and history that represented people's attempts at understanding the same phenomena we're quantifying in science. And I didn't necessarily have the language for that, but I was really comfortable shifting between, well, I understand continental drift, I understand plate tectonics, and, you know, orogenesis is the reason we have this mountain, but I really love this poetic myth of, you know, a giant hurling rocks, or the, you know, devil being to drop this massive landform, or whatever it was going to be. And I didn't see them at odds with one another. I kind of felt that one gave us firm answers and the other gives us a better way to relate in both science and, we'll kind of say, the broader spiritual strokes of humanity are just ways that we relate to the world. So, unbeknownst to me, people still did the things that I read about in the folkloric record, the kind of ancient religions and mythologies that, I'd read about existing so long ago were still things that people believed in and practiced and built relationships toward. And so this kind of organic practice I had of greeting the sun by many names of many deities, or connecting to the earth or the ocean. Oh God, I loved the ocean as a kid, in similar forms, really kind of all came together when I very stereotypically encountered Teen Witch as a not quite teen, in that era. And then I wanted to learn everything that I could about Wicca and witchcraft and paganism, and then into the kind of general occult. And one of like the big pieces that tied it all together for me was shifting from reading about the folklore of rocks and minerals, as well as their science, to understanding that there were people who still had a practice of healing, of other flavors of spirituality, because it's not always about, hands-on healing, with crystals, and that it wasn't just this historic thing. We can put it in a neat little box and study the way it used to be, but it is still a living, breathing thing where people are introducing new modes of awareness, new minerals, new formations, new techniques. And so I really allowed that to be my focus. And so a lot of the other things that I learned and studied were kind of peripheral to that. So I loved the witchy world because there was gemstone magic. I loved learning a little bit of astrology because of the kind of talismanic associations of gems related to the planets and signs, and so on and so forth. And then as the years went on, when I'd find something else that really resonated with me, I'd kind of dig in as deep as I had access to. When you're a poor college kid, stressed to the nines studying music, you don't have a lot of spare resources, but you develop a practice to stay grounded through all of that to the best of your ability. And rocks have been one of the kind of foundations of that. But I've along the way, I found flower essences and plant spirits and so many other things that initially were ancillary, but now are just such a core part of my practice. So I'm kind of glad that I had time to be a loner and time to not understand what church meant, because it really gave me freedom to figure some stuff out on my own.
And then, some things that, not everyone thinks about is that everyone has their own path towards spirituality, towards whatever you want to call it, divinity, God, goddess, great spirit. So I think it's wonderful when people can have that time and space where they're not interjected with someone else's beliefs to, form their own. I think it's beautiful. So you have a new book that just came out, right? And it's Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense. And can you tell us a little bit about that book?
This book feels like it took a million years to write. So if we go back in time to 2019, I had finished up like the last edits and proofreads and everything on Crystal Basics, which came out in February 2020. And so I am not really good about putting breathing space between projects. Sometimes I start the next one before I'm really done with the But once I got everything done, I took a step back and I thought, okay, I would like to pursue something that will answer a lot of questions. What do people ask me about more than anything? Also, what tools have I really leaned on in the past couple of years? And so the idea of protection with crystals came forward. At this point, I was working near full time, in one of our local very long-standing occult bookstores, and like the number one question is always related to protection, and the things kind of tangential to that, but really themes of safety, security, protection, out with the old and with the new, they're all kind of like foundational to the human experience. So I thought, if I can write a book on this, then I can still answer those questions face to face, but I can collect all of the tools and techniques in one place for people who want to go farther, or who need more than that 2-minute conversation where I hand them some black tourmaline and some cedar and send them on their way in the world. Like sometimes that's all people have space for. And you're like, oh, this is not going to cut it, but I'm going to give you the pep talk anyway. And if it works, if the pep talk works, then the rest of it should work as well. That's kind of where the idea was born. I also, like, selfishly, I'm a really sensitive person in every interpretation of that word. And so I had to learn a lot of these skills for myself. And then in still kind of the initial stages of writing this book, 2020 happened. I don't need to like give an itemized list of all the things globally
No.
in 2020, because we live, we get
We
it.
all lived through the Great Pause.
And the urgency with which people needed help with those same foundational themes of safety, security, protection, it increased a hundredfold, maybe. I also increased the amount of time that I was working with the public face to face in that kind of venue, because I wasn't traveling. I wasn't able to go out and, do the things with the new book tour for Crystal Basics. It really did reiterate that talking about protection in an extended format was timely. But I also want to acknowledge that we were all collectively going through shit. And so this wasn't my normal writing project where I just kind of dug in and finished it. I had to press pause a lot. Stuff came up for me that I had to work through. I encountered things in the community that, like, I didn't know how to effectively hold as much space for, and had to work through that and learn, and ask questions and be silent and all kinds of things. So, I like to think that if I, uninterrupted, written the book start to finish, starting in 2019, 6 months later, it would be a very different kind of book than it is. But as it stands, it took about 5 years to finish. I did write two other books, so it wasn't, just devoted to this. It's not my magnum opus that I put my whole life into it. I pressed pause, and I really wondered whether or not I was ever going to get it done. And when I did come back to it, I clearly had at least enough familiarity with some other core concepts that I really needed, and willingness to also lean into the uncomfortable bits. Most books on crystals, when it comes to talking about protection, they keep it pretty light. Because I think the average reader, the average practitioner, only needs that much, or at least only needed that much. But collectively, when the kind of collective shadow of the whole world is raised up to you, you gotta have a better anchor point for yourself. You're gonna need the tools that you need to, like, build resiliency. It's not just the strength to, like, face that aggressively. It's knowing when to rest and how to rest. It's maybe also learning how to stand your ground when things get really rough. So I wanted to include things we don't usually find in crystal books, things like banishing, binding. There's actually a crystal curse in it. Two, technically, one more historically informed than the other. And my genuine hope is that these things don't ever need to get used. I would love it if people read this and go, oh, I'll flag this away for later, and then they never come back to it. That's like the ideal situation. But I wanted to have those if-then statements covered, where when we are encountering abuse or subjugation or, systemic disempowerment, that we've got some things that we can kind of fall back on that are more than just, all right, let's wave some sparkly selenite through our aura and carry some hematite, which are probably great for most days, but real life happens. And so a lot of real life happened on the collective and also on the personal when writing this book. So it kind of branched out in a few different directions simultaneously.
And it probably is a richer book because of those experiences.
I think so. My hope is that it meets the needs of a lot of different people. So, there are probably some folks who are a little bit more occulty that are going to enjoy some of the later chapters and ignore some of the earlier ones. And there are going to be my healy-feely people who love those early chapters and may never need to encounter the techniques in the later ones. And as long as they can reconcile, there's a chapter or two that may not be relevant to their practice, that's great. And otherwise, my other objective in writing this book, also kind of selfish, other than the fact that I needed to work through some stuff and thought it might help others, was I always like to include things I've never written about when it comes to the kinds of crystals in my books. So I gave myself the challenge of like 20%, at least 20% of the books in the direct, the crystals in the directory of the book had to be things that don't appear in any of my other books. And I think I just beat it. So even someone who's got the whole Nicholas Pearson library, 20% of these rocks aren't going to be in any of those. So I could introduce some new things to my practice. And some of them were born out of necessity. Like I needed new techniques. We collectively needed new techniques. So new stones showed up for that. And the other part of it was born from curiosity. I got to do a little bit of traveling toward the latter stages of writing this book, got overseas to the UK. And so I got to really forge a very deep love affair with some British rocks, some of which I already knew and loved, and some were things that I just met kind of circumstantially that I knew needed a place, so they ended up in this book too.
Yeah. It is always nice finding a new crystal or rock to work with. Like I have experienced, like when we've gone to Scotland, I worked with jade from the Isle of Skye, and it's very powerful. So just 'cause we're talking about it, what practice can people use to help themselves during these trying energetic times that we're all going through to keep clear and protected?
Yeah, so ahead of writing this book, when I was enrolled in W1, my favorite module of the whole year was the one on protection magic. And so I like devoured all of the text for it. I went through every possible iteration of every psychic shield, and then some. And as I was working through the ones that were assigned, I thought, I think there are some crystals that are really well suited to this kind of practice. And like my go-to for introducing new folks to like this kind of crystal psychic shield synergy is labradorite. So like getting some labradorite, or at least getting familiar with it if you don't have it in your collection and can find pictures or better yet videos online so you can see the way it interacts with the light. Imagine that you just kind of flood your energy field, your aura, with this light that labradorite has. Allow that light to crystallize, no pun intended, around the perimeter of the aura. And it creates this kind of selectively permeable membrane. So the way that labradorite's Schiller, it's labradorescence happens because of these layers of varying thicknesses and also slightly different crystal chemistries come together. They like get stacked. We call them laminae, like the same as the word to laminate. So we've and the varying thicknesses and refractive indices in them will selectively filter out just a specific wavelength of light or a very small band of wavelengths of light, and so it's kind of the same effect as an oil slick on water or blowing bubbles. The way you get that iridescent color shifting is from the amount of thickness in that solution. So with labradorite, some layers admit all of the light, some layers admit most of the light, some layers might not admit very much light at all. And when we kind of create this shield of labradorite, its effect is twofold. It selectively filters out the things that are harmful or disruptive or not useful to us, and while still allowing us to let things out as well, when we have those really, opaque white light or really, really firm oppressive boundaries, you're going to stew in your own juices all day long. This was a challenge that I'd learned as a sensitive person trying protective magic in my youth. It like fixed one problem and created another one. So I love that this is breathable. It allows you to exhale. The other thing that it does is the structure of labradorite creates this optical illusion of that, iridescent flash, that multicolored flash. There's no pigment in it doing that. It's entirely structural. It's just scrambling up ordinary light to make it seem even more extraordinary. And so, in addition to filtering out and in whatever we need, it has the ability to like crank up your own light to increase the volume of it so it drowns out the noise of the world that might otherwise kind of hold us back. And that's gonna have a whole lot of effects. Maybe boosting our confidence, improving our kind of general magic or manifestation, helping us align with a sense of purpose, making us more resilient. We bounce back faster because we shine brighter. And those are all really like wonderful qualities. So like that Labradorite shield is something that I try to tell everybody about who's got space for it or an interest in it. So that's one that I think is really great when we're bombarded by so much stuff. It is easy to focus on the negative, but good things are still happening. By and large, there are lots of great things still happening. And sometimes we get really myopic, put our blinders on, and say, if I only look at this teeny tiny corner of life, it's magnificent. Well, it can help us embrace that. It doesn't take away from the fact that terrible things are still going on, but it allows us to receive the good that's still in the world, to contribute to the good that's still in the world. So I think during, really trying, really turbulent, really uncertain times, Labradorite's a great gemstone.
Yeah. Well, thank you. All right. So, I'm trying to figure out where I was in my questions. That's so silly. So do you think that there are spiritual people who are more aligned or attuned to the crystal and mineral kingdoms? And if so, what do you think are some of the signs of that?
This is an interesting question. I think there's probably a couple of ways we can look at it. There's, from like the very human kind of psychological level, we all like different stuff. We're all going to be wired toward different stuff. I know lots of plant people who have almost zero interest in crystals and vice versa. You meet people who are like really excited about color and less so about sound, or some that are really into scent, and we all have our kind of ways in. So I think on the one hand, we can think of it through that lens. Like we're going to have our proclivities because we all have different interests. But from this kind of energetic perspective, we're all influenced by rock and mineral. I'm sitting here in my office. We're communicating through some electronic devices. There are valuable ores that have been refined and extracted and smelted, and we got the precious metals and the other like important metals that are in this. The concrete bricks in my office are made out of crushed rock and other minerals. The copper wiring in our walls, the glass is made out of silicates, and just everything around us is shaped by the mineral world. So we can't ever be away from it. But I do think there are people who gravitate towards it because maybe they just resonate a little bit more inharmonically to it. Like we just naturally sync up with it. The mineral sphere is there to support all of us, but I think it's a pretty common phenomenon that a lot of us who become lifelong crystal lovers or rock hounds or geologists or just witchy people and healy-feely people, we gravitate towards them in childhood. As a kid, I picked up rocks everywhere. Like, those really magical and exotic places, like a family vacation to the mountains, because I'm from Florida, and in my entire home county, not just my hometown, but established whole county, is the highest point is like 32 feet above sea level. So like a mountain is just a whole other universe to me. But then, the really common and humble places like the grocery store parking lot, find this little quartz pebble and it talks to me, and it has to come home. So there's that side of it, but I also think there's a kind of energy that crystals have that is slow and methodical. Most minerals form slowly. I mean, obviously we've got, volcanic events and similar things that create rock in pretty quick amounts of time, comparatively speaking. But crystals themselves are so highly ordered, so structured, so repeatable and predictable. And I think a lot of the people who are drawn to crystals are either in great need of slowing down and creating order, or they are great masters of those things. So those might be some signs as well, like maybe our life is a little too unpredictable. Let's slow down and learn to approach the pace of rocks as best we can as biological things. If we have too much disarray in our lives, like my desk right now, maybe the idea of crystallinity appeals to us as a, like an internal kind of order that we can achieve. And when we are masters of those things, also I think we're just naturally kind of in sync with the crystal world. But you know, ultimately, follow the tools, the allies, the techniques that resonate with you. And it's okay to sample from the buffet. It's okay to be just a rock person or a little bit of everything.
And I think also putting forth, it's okay to go through phases of intense, working with a certain thing. I found throughout my witchy life that I will get super intense about things, and I don't know if that's like some sort of adult ADHD thing, but you get super intense into it and you're just working it. And then one day you're just like, oh, I'm going to work with this now. Do-do-do. And you go on. But, people who are fey like me will cycle back to those things and they become integrated over time. So, one of the teachings that I got from a fiction book of all places when I was younger, I think it was called The Secret Circle. That was an idea that everyone has their own power stone or one that resonates with our essential nature, kind of like in homeopathy, where they have your there's one type of homeopathy that is your like essential healer. Do you think that is true? And if so, what is yours?
I love this idea. So I remember these books fondly. I read them in middle school. I think for those of us who make a really intimate study of crystal energy, not just like study as in an academic sense, but we apply the energy of crystals to our lives, we tend to find one or maybe more than one stone that becomes this really intimate ally for us in a lot of ways. So we could think of that as maybe a constitutional remedy with that kind of homeopathic lens. We might think of it as like our kind of chief stone spirit ally through a more animistic lens. And I think it is possible to have one we go back to over and over again. I also think it is possible that we have one that represents a phase we're going through or a cycle that we're living in this moment. And we can develop almost like a team of them. And I think at the core, my longest standing kind of constitutional gemstone is one that I'm a little bit I have a little bit more distance from right now. I still appreciate and love it very, very much. It is one of my favorites. But it is not one I find myself working with every single day like I did for, I don't know, more than a decade and a half, I'm sure. I suspect in the coming days and weeks and months and, you know, about 4 years, it'll be an ally that I will rely on more and more, and that is Petersite. And Petersite is kind of an interesting case of a couple of really common ingredients that are just brought together in extraordinary ways. So it is chiefly made out of quartz. We consider it a variety of chalcedony, which is cryptocrystalline quartz. It's got these tiny fibers of silica that are so small we can't see them except with like really powerful microscopy. And this quartz forms coevally with a fibrous amphibole mineral, rubikite or chrysolite, depending on a few different naming conventions. And they begin to nucleate around tiny, tiny little seed crystals of hematite. So, I mean, In isolation, these three things pretty unremarkable. If we brought them together in the right kind of environment, they would just make Tiger's Eye. We know that. I loved Tiger's Eye as a kid until I met Peter Zeit, and then it was like I never looked back. But Peter Zeit has a couple of other extenuating factors. And one of those is what we call brecciation, from the Italian breccia, meaning broken. Like the material as it's forming literally fractures into irregular fragments, and what was once long kind of parallel fibers of this amphibole material are now kind of reassembled. More silica comes in, more heat or pressure, other things can also come in. Occasionally we find other kinds of materials that get folded up into it. And it creates this like patchwork quilt. So instead of the chatoyants being all in one more or less direction, the gemological term for the optical phenomenon in this stone is chaotic chatoyants. And so different states of oxidation will give us different colors. We can have blues and reds, golds, sometimes greens and purples. You've got, the earthy matrix. Sometimes little bits of hematite or pyrite are visible in there. And it occurs in very, very few places on Earth. The original discovery is in Namibia. There is another find of it that's a little bit more magnesium rich in China in the 90s. And something that is not well publicized is that it's also found in all places in 1 square half mile in New Jersey, in a place
Wow.
like a dried up stream bed where they mostly find carnelian. but there is this New Jersey analog they call Tushonite. But this stone has such a chaotic formation process that it teaches us a lot about entropy, about chaos, about surrender. In the 90s, especially 80s and 90s, it took on the trade name of Tempest Stone because, especially the kind of dark blue varieties, they look like swirling storm clouds. And being a South Florida boy growing up on the coast, hurricane season was, a big deal and also not at the same time. Like it's only a big deal when it has to be. But I lived through some pretty life-changing storms, and thank goodness we always came out okay. But I mean, you'd like drive through your hometown after a storm, and parts of it can be unrecognizable. And there's something really magical about the nature of a storm, the way we get all of these kind of elemental forces coalescing into one greater body, one greater system. And Peter Zeit invites us not to look at the individual separate pieces that look chaotic, but to take a step back and see how they can all fit together to make something that has a state of dynamic balance. It's not static balance. You can't just, stack all the bits up and walk away. Like this is something that's going to teeter and move and requires attention. But when we can embrace that, we can move into the eye of the storm. And with a hurricane, with other kind of cyclonic formations, the very, very center of that will be blue skies. And so, I mean, every year every storm, there are people who think the storm has passed. They go outside because it's quiet, and then other side of the eye hits them, and it's bad news all around. But the magic of Peter Zeit is when we can learn to embrace our own willpower, our pursuit of truth, an awareness of who we are on a very deep core level, we can enter and occupy the eye of the storm. So no matter what chaos is happening in the world around us, we can still cultivate a sense of stillness within. And it is an intense power. And moving against those winds, against the rain, against the raging torment, to get to the eye can be hard. So it lifts stuff up. It throws it in your face. It invites you to kind of attend to the things you've neglected. But when we can enter that innermost part, there's an immense kind of satisfaction of knowing thyself that comes from that. So it is a stone that I have grown to love. And I've worn it so many years of my life, but maybe in the last couple of years, I've kind of slowed down my work with Peter Zeit.
Yeah. I find so for myself, it's rutilated quartz. If I'm out in the world looking for stones and stuff, it will call me without me really trying. It was also the first stone that was given to me, that I could wear. And so, for myself, I think, partially it made me have such fabulous hair. And but also like it enhanced like my ability to manifest, to also to telepathically, communicate with others, which is a skill that I had to work on stopping, because I would say things that people were thinking, and that was not good. But I find I will return to it when I feel like I need to rebalance myself into it. But I'm with you on the Labradorite, and I'm wearing a lot of it today. I cycle through those things. Along that vein, though, do you feel that there are certain crystals that someone might not resonate with or not be able to work with? Though I do find that that can sometimes be a temporary thing as we go through our crystal journey through life. But what do you think about that?
I've had really strong opinions on this in the past, and I think I've got a little bit more grace for a both and situation. So, conventional crystal wisdom tells us that if you find a crystal that doesn't feel right, it's just not for you. And whether that's a specific example, it's not all rose quartz. It's this one sphere that you touched feels icky, so that one is not for you. I think oftentimes we do a lot of projection of our own expectations and our own baggage. And crystals, among many things, that one of the fundamental things that crystals offer to us energetically is this ability to reflect to us. We see it in their structural properties and their optical properties, just a thing that all crystals do. And a lot of times when we experience a crystal that feels uncomfortable, it has very little to do with the crystal itself. Maybe that stone needs to be cleansed. Maybe, it's right stone, wrong place, wrong time. There are a lot of different ways that we can do it. But over the years, I kind of switched gears from that like conventional stance to really thinking about what is it about, a handful of stones that I have discomfort with even to this day. What are they trying to show to me? How do I see the same patterns showing up with others? And I've really gotten to a place where I think most of the time when someone feels really uncomfortable around a crystal, especially when we're talking, not just that piece of rose quartz, but all rose quartz. You don't just dislike that hematite skull. You think hematite always gives you the heebie-jeebies. Oftentimes that's a reflection of work that we've got to do. It tends to be, in my experience, from what I can see and observe, that a lot of times when we encounter those stones, they reflect something about our journey that is unresolved. The crystals that feel like they are home to us, they're like second nature and that always make us feel warm and fuzzy, they tend to represent something we've already mastered energetically, on a soul level, psychically, you name it. There's something about it that just fits into place because we've already done that work. They can absolutely take it to a new level. They can refine it. They're multifaceted beings, no pun intended. So are we. So they do other things as well and can help us grow in that way. But it's those crystals that feel the most foreign to us, that are somehow uncomfortable or invite us to feel vulnerable in ways we didn't expect, that often give us the greatest healing potential. So yeah, there absolutely could be crystals that you just don't resonate with, and it's okay that you never pursue it. But I always invite people, if there's a trend, if it's not just in my case, intellectually, I understand that I should love rhodochrosite. I appreciate therapeutically what its like underlying mechanisms are. It's pretty to look at. It comes in a variety of crystal forms. I have some really nice pieces. But if you ask me to wear some rhodochrosite all day, I'm going to say no, thank you. And I have enough self-awareness to know why that might be. And rhodochrosite has shown up for me in some big ways, and so I've work through that discomfort from time to time, although I've also had to circle back around to it from time to time. And when we see those trends, those crystals even if they don't feel great, can often help us get through some really big energetic stuff in sometimes pretty short time. And I'm not suggesting that, if you decide through like self-inventory that emerald is not the right stone for you, that you go out and buy the biggest and most expensive emerald that you can and wear it all day long. That's probably not great for anyone. It's just like when you're going to the gym, you don't say, okay, well, I want bigger biceps, so I'm gonna put 100 pounds on this barbell and start there. We start small and we work our way up to it. So you don't have to get the, 4 ounce emerald and strap it to your third eye all day long. You can start with that little tumbled stone that you put in a pouch with other tumbled stones, and you take it out and leave it at home when it's not resonating with you, and then pick it up when you have the space, the bandwidth to do it. And when we do encounter those stones that feel uncomfortable, I think it's a really great practice to do some journaling, to just reflect on how we feel and maybe how that could be similar to other times in our lives we felt that way, because the crystals could be like stirring stuff up. And then also practice really good spiritual hygiene. Cleanse yourself, your stones, your space. As you like lift that stuff up, we don't want to leave that kind of psychic debris around us, because that's only going to exacerbate things. But they can provide some really wonderful and deep healing when we allow that to take place.
Yeah. And I know from my own work, like early on, I had a aversion to aventurine. I did not like green. I didn't like green aventurine. I had it, I had a piece and I wore it, and I would have the most, excuse my French, but fucked up luck. Like, and things would be like, I'd say something and it would happen, or things like that, which some people might want, but for me, I was like, I don't really need this right now. And it took me many years to come back to it, and it was actually a shamanic journey where I went and talked to the spirit of aventurine and became aligned with it again, that I could actually work with it. So we all go through crazy journeys. So you have written many books on spirituality, and I, for one, am a little bit jealous of how fast you crank them out. Do you have a specific crystal technique that helps you in your writing?
Well, thank you. Some things happen pretty effortlessly. I famously wrote a book in 27 days once. We're not going to pretend that it was a great draft, but it was a draft. And then, on the other side of the spectrum, crystals for psychic self-defense took like 5 years. So some things flow better than others. And I don't know that there's necessarily one single practice that has helped me through all of them. But because I tend to focus on a given topic in a book, it's whatever that theme is, I embody. So crystals for psychic self-defense, starting with practices of cleansing and spiritual hygiene and personal protection and warding our spaces and so on and so forth, living those things, living the teachings. And the universe must have a sense of humor, because when we put out into the universe what the topic of a project might be, we encounter lots of opportunities to walk our talk, lots of them. And sometimes we do that with ease and grace. And lots of other times we go, oh, fuck, I was not prepared for this. So back to the drawing board we go. So like in my first book is weird because it's only about seven stones, and it was about meeting those seven stones in a deep way, in a really intellectual way, but then also like just to have the raw personal gnosis with each and every one, to have that kind of inspired component to the writing. So I think whatever it is we want to write about, it's learning to give ourselves over to that practice, to make space for it on a regular basis, regular and frequent. They're not the same thing. Something once a week, you're doing it on a regular cycle. But certainly if we want to write in short order, both regular and frequent together are useful. And then just on a practical side of things, I do keep a few crystals here at the desk, and it's going to change depending on the flavor of the book that I'm writing. So, this last, well, the last one to come out, this most recent one, because I've two other books I've written. I was finishing this one. But when writing this one, the kinds of crystals that appeared around my desk were kind of more geared towards that. And some things, like I always keep labradorite by my computer because, again, it has that filtering quality, and I use it to interface with the world, whether it's through the written word, in a manuscript or email, or on Zoom to record an interview, or whatever else it might be. I also keep fluorite at my desk. Fluorite is a really good one for our structure, order, organization. It helps us stay centered and keep our mind clear. It also helps us with discipline. So there is always fluorite on my desk. I have two pieces right now, and I give them breaks. I never intended this, but every now and then I'll just go, yeah, I don't want you in my line of sight anymore. And it's not really that I have a problem with the crystal. It's just something else needs to come in. So, like I had a piece of root beer brown fluorite from Clay Center, Ohio, on my desk for 2 years while writing this book. And like as soon as I switched projects, a different piece of fluorite showed up, and I didn't even make the connection. I pulled it to do other work, and then without that fluorite here, another one kind of came through. So those are like two staples in my practice. I also really love having chrysocolla in my space. Chrysocolla, among other things, has this quality of expression, and there's a deep Venusian quality to it because it's a copper silicate mineral, and Venus, she rules arts and beauty, and she's not just the goddess of love, although we want to have work. The other thing that I find really interesting about chrysocolla in this case is that it helps us join things together. It helps us take the kind of inward quality, the idea that permeates from us, and create something that is bigger. The word chrysocolla comes from Greek, chrysos, meaning gold, and choline, to glue or to stick together. So it's theorized that something once upon a time was called chrysocolla, maybe not this, that when smelted, produced compounds that could be used in the making of gold solder. So maybe the copper and alumina from this was part of that. Who really knows? But it's this idea of, like, the gold symbolizing the logos, the self, the persona, and then using the gold solder, the gold glue, to stick things together, or to help it become more whole or bigger. So it helps us find that central narrative in the project, and find all the other parts and pieces that are going to fit into it to make one cohesive whole.
That's lovely. So, as a prolific writer and lecturer, what's one of the most rewarding aspects of sharing your knowledge with the public, and what keeps you passionate about your work?
Honestly, it's the light bulb moments that people have. I live for that. It's so much harder to experience them remotely and online. Although people, they'll chime into the chat or email me afterwards, and those are really lovely. But like passing around a crystal that maybe nobody's ever heard of, or maybe everyone's like over familiar with, and seeing the light bulb go off because they're experiencing it in a new way, or because they see how it fits into their life, or when teaching Reiki and people have that like first, like really visceral sensation of energy. Those are the things that inspire me so much. And then the other part of it is I'm just a nerd. Like, I just love to learn. The reason I teach is because I enjoy learning so much. And if I learn something, maybe someone else will benefit from learning it. And if someone asks me something I don't have the answer to, well, now I want to go learn and become better educated within reason. Something not my job to learn because someone else has done it better, and I can point them in that direction. But yeah, being able to inspire other people to take matters into their own hands. Not just the light bulb moments of, oh, I get this one thing, but now that I get this one thing, I think I understand how to approach all of the things under this umbrella myself. And if they can see that I don't really have a superpower here. Like, okay, maybe I'm better than average at pattern recognition and I retain a lot more information about certain topics than most people. Other than that, I'm really quite ordinary. They can achieve the same things. So if I show them my model for what works, they'll do that. And to share a not very well guarded secret, I have an ulterior motive in every one of my books, and that is to like demonstrate how to think for yourself. If you do the things that are in this book, the techniques as written, they have an effect. But if you start to read between the lines and follow the narrative of each book and see that it's not just, oh, we're not just learning about the history of Flint. We're learning about how understanding Flint through this kind of historic lens and its geologic lens and all this other stuff teaches us something about the nature of Flint. I can go learn about any crystal and apply those same filters to it and understand the nature of that stone itself. So those are like my favorite success stories. Or when people go, hey, I really loved what you said about obsidian in this book, and I was working with it, and then I pulled out another stone, and it really reminded me of this experience, and I took it in a whole new direction. Like that excites me to see how people can feel empowered, not just in the moment, but in the long term, and let that kind of fuel their larger journey.
That's excellent. What in your personal practice is helping you right now?
Well, definitely that Labradorite shield. I'm a big fan of having more than one tool in your toolkit at any moment. However, I often use the analogy when talking about like psychic self-defense that if you are talking about our physical security, if someone breaks into your home because they learn how to pick the lock, we don't just lock the door. We also install a deadbolt, and maybe we change the lock, and then we get the alarm system, and then maybe a camera system, and then we get a big scary dog or whatever it might be. So we've got more than one thing that's going to work for any situation. So definitely, I'm using the Labradorite shield, but there are a few other tools that I think are like really helpful for me in the moment, and one of them is decidedly unmagical. Well, at least superficially, and it's trying to do less stuff. I'm not exactly an overachiever, but I do like to stay busy. And when I like anything, I try to do as much of that thing as possible. And it's exhausting. The news cycle, the state of the world is designed to exhaust us, to confuse us, to incite fear. So, like I have a couple mantras for the year. I'm not really big on New Year's resolutions, but I'm trying this year out a little bit differently by setting some like very specific themes, and one of them is less consuming, more creating. Like what can I do that is creative? That can be tending my garden. It can be tidying bookshelves, which I haven't done yet. It could, of course, be writing a manuscript or answering emails. But just find ways to redirect and reorient your attention so we're not stuck in the downward spiral that we're like literally designed to be in right now. If there are magical things that you can do that support that, so like lighting the appropriate incense or herb, or infusing the space with an essential oil or a flower essence if you just want the vibration rather than the scent, unplugging literally and go soaking in the tub or go on a walk through the woods or whatever you've got. Just try to do less and be present more and be present for what really matters. The hope is that if we engage with our magical practice, we are becoming more present. If we engage in our healing practice, we're becoming more present. All of this really is about the here and the now. We can't affect the same level of change to the past or the future as we can right now. And those are kind of my guiding lights at the moment.
I love that. I know for myself, I decided this year not to do the New Year's resolution kind of goals, that I saw this practice that was to choose one word that would inspire you or be your touchstone throughout the year. And I chose the word trust, which is very challenging at this time right now. But I, will sometimes come to my altar and go, I trust, and then fill in the blank. Like, I trust my guidance, I trust my guides, I trust myself, I trust that, like everything is going to work out. Like kind of things like that, to sort of set that energy. Anyway, I feel like you've already done this, but what is the best advice either that you have been given or has come to you that you think could help the community?
Actually, I have a really great piece of advice that comes from someone in our community, from Dan Lupacino. So, and it was a little piece of information that helped inform the whole writing of this book. So Dan is a very beloved friend and colleague of mine. Probably before I ever set pen to paper to start this book, we were, one sensitive person to another, having like a really honest conversation about that. And Dan said to me something that I will never forget. And he said, I'm going to give you a piece of information that I will share this advice with like my long-term clients, my more advanced folks. And it amounts to something to mind your own damn business. Like if you are a really sensitive person, if you are very, very psychic, if you are, a medium with no filter, if you are an empath, if you're just hyper vigilant in life, mind your own fucking business. Like, okay, the grocery store is overwhelming. I get it. I feel that too. But the like emotional breakdown the woman two carts over had 30 minutes before she came into the store that I can feel if I get nosy has nothing to do with me. Other people's opinions of me online largely have nothing to do with me as well. Whatever it is, I think. It is really helpful for the sensitive people of the world. And that's, I include so many people under this umbrella. That's, our neurodivergent folks, our people who experience trauma, our psychics, our healers, our empaths, our witches and magicians, because we sensitize ourselves to unseen currents. You hold the remote control, you get to change the station you're paying attention to. So why not pay attention to one that benefits you more directly? Why not choose one that is more constructive, one that is more relaxing, one that's more empowering, one that is more useful than just the fray of the world? You can turn the television on static and try to like pay attention to every single pixel. You will get overwhelmed. You can also turn the television off and say, you know what? I'm not going to pay attention to anything but me. And that's a really powerful thing. So Dan gave me that advice, and I have like run with it over the years. It has been super useful. And when we are being flooded on an energetic level, on an emotional level, on a social, on a political, on every different way, like just mind your own damn business. Some of this stuff is not about you, and you gotta really turn your attention to what you'd have agency over.
Yeah, and what you can control. Thank you. So where can our listeners find you and your work?
Well, thank you. So if anyone wants to check out one of my books, please find your local independent bookseller. You can also buy them online, wherever books are sold. The new one, Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense, just came out, I think in just about every market. So please go find it. If you want to learn more about the other things that I do, you can find me online at theluminouspearl.com. You can read all about my books, my upcoming classes, read more about me and the work that I do, sign up for my newsletter, and once or twice a month get, a little update on where I'm going to be and where what I'll be teaching, whether that's online or in person. And if anyone does the social media thing, in most instances, I'm at the Luminous Pearl on social media, and the links to all of this stuff is also on the website for anyone who wants to track me down.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being here. I think we'll just close our space unless you have anything else you want to say.
Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. We thank the Great Spirit and the two who move as one. We thank the three rays of love, will, and wisdom. We thank the goddess and the god and the lords and the ladies who move through us and work with us. May we recognize your presence in our lives. Blessed be. Merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again.
You've been listening to Voices of the Temple. The contents of this podcast are copyright 2010 of the Temple of Witchcraft. For more information, please visit templeofwitchcraft.org.